over yak babies, sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, a new podcast on the internet sponsored by Tiny Teddy's Hypno Cream, the only cream endorsed by a small man. My name's Aaron. Here are the personal pals, Dave.
Hey, boys.
Brit. Hey, boys.
And calling from old Ireland, old Irish Nico.
Hey, boys.
There we go. It's been a long time since we've done Story Club on this podcast, and we're bringing it back, baby. This time with a story that I did not remember until I started reading it. I was like, oh, I read this before. The title had no resonance for me whatsoever when you mentioned it in the group text, and then Dave sent me the text of it, and I was like, oh, yeah, I do remember this quite clearly. A story called Sea Oak by George Saunders. Dave, tell us about the story. Where did it come from? Why did you pick it out for us to read?
I did not.
Oh, great. Okay. well, hi.
I did.
Nico, okay, you tell us.
So I remember this story like you do, Aaron. Well, I guess first we should say, you know, we're going to spoil everything. So if you want to read this story, you can find it for free pretty easily if you just Google CEO George Saunders. And it's worth a read, I'd say. And it's one of those stories.
We're going to talk about it, so it better be.
The end.
Kind of adjacent to another one of our podcast topics that we haven't actually done yet. What makes a book memorable, or what do you remember about books? This like a couple of the parts of this book or this story have stuck with me, and I remember very clearly the aunt coming back from the dead and like falling apart, sitting in her recliner and telling the son, who's the narrator, show your cock at the strip club where you work. And that has like I have remembered in for 15 years since I probably last read this story. When I proposed it, I was looking forward to read it because I had remembered it for so long, and to see like kind of how it held up. And I'm kind of not sure how it held up. I kind of mixed feelings about it. What do you guys think, I guess, to start? Like, did you like it? Did you like it as much as the last time you read it?
Yeah, this came out in 1998 in The New Yorker. It was when it was originally published. It was collected in a collection in 2000s. This is a vintage story at this point, which was interesting to think about too, because it feels very contemporary to me. It feels very tied to the recent moment somehow, which is surprising. I really love the story. I think the story is great. What I love about it, I think, probably on the first read too, and certainly on this read, is we get a kind of conventional or typical sort of like slice of life story, you know, a family going through hard times where it's kind of dysfunctional, everyone's kind of a shit in their own way, the one figure who isn't dies sadly, and that affects the rest of their lives, but filtered through this lens of like wackadoo references and just like, I don't know, like a sort of skewed thing that makes that story defamiliar in a really satisfying way. Because all of a sudden, the things that kind of story structure leads you into, feeling sorry for certain characters or not, or judging them, disappears. And you stop, you have a different, at least I did, I think, I had a different orientation towards the characters than I would if it was just a quote-unquote normal story. You know, all the stuff about the way they interact with their children, the sisters, like the shows they watch on TV, like How My Child Died Horribly, whatever, all those kinds of like those funny kind of Vonnegutian details make it feel totally different in a way that I really like.
Yeah, the children that die on TV, but in made up ways. And it's like,
yeah, simulations of horrible
yeah.
Horrible, like that things. A lot. Yeah. Even all the details of the strip club joysticks, just the absurd idea of male strip club that's pilot themed, where they have like mock-ups of old planes you can sit in.
Yeah.
Like you can take a tour and see pictures of old airfields or whatever, and then maybe see some guy's dick. It's a really funny detail.
But you can't see his dick. You're not supposed to see his dick.
You're not supposed to, right. But
you can see the penis protuberance or whatever they call it that fits like over his dick.
Yeah, the cock simulator or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not funny just to be funny, right? I think the funniness is there to twist and sort of warp your interpretation of the story so that by the end, the last lines are a real gut punch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what about the rest of you?
So you mean like the absurdity of it and the sort of semi-otherworldliness of it like made you not judge the characters in a way you may have otherwise?
Yeah, because it's almost like they're cartoons, right? So they, you start to, you wonder, like, how does logic apply to them? Like, how do you judge Min and Jay, the two sisters, when they seem to be, they're not even caricatures, they're just like these, like, gonzo creations who don't respond and don't sort of like have any connection to what seems like normal morality or like human reaction to outside stimulus, right?
Yeah.
But it still is so close to, I mean, they're still obviously human, they have like human features, that you sort of have that tension between like, well, I want to judge them, but also like, well, who are they really? The main character is the closest one to like having normal reactions, but even those are still bizarre, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a moral story, at least on the in that way, because it's not like you should feel these characters are wrong or right. Instead, I think it wants you to feel sad about the circumstances that cause those lives to happen by the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he wanted to write a story about class and then was like, and then realized that, you know, nobody ever seems to give a shit about this stuff. But maybe if I make it feel separate from our reality in this really, in these really funky ways, then maybe people will pay attention and see what's underneath.
Yeah, I think you're right. But and people pay attention, but also if we don't have to filter it through, if we're not filtering it through the traditional lenses, then you're not, or if it feels different and off, like a cartoon, you're not going to come into it with a sense of like, oh, well, you know, I'm tired of stories about characters who don't want to get a job because they're lazy.
Right.
It's like, what does getting a job mean in this world? Like, what does any of that mean?
Right.
All the jobs, they, even when the, when Aunt Bernie comes back in her like weird zombie ghost superhero form, she wants, like, the job she's asking them to get sound weird. It's like, go to a label store or just like that. It's not sure what she wants them to do. It's like they all, it's all like static versions of real life, I think. And that inhibits you from the judging them. Instead, I think activates empathy
more. Yeah, it feels like a different story if Min and June are watching like Wheel of Fortune and then Jeopardy.
Yeah, it feels sad, and but sad in a different way. It feels like, oh God, these lives. Whereas the sadness here is more like being alive is hard. It's a different sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At first, it felt to me almost like he was making fun of him, and I didn't like it. And then eventually, I kind of stopped trying to insert it into reality and remembered I was reading George Saunders, and then it kind of helped have that read instead.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Brick. Because I can see that thinking too. I think he's not wanting to make fun of the characters, but making fun of or like turning that critical eye on, I guess, like American culture kind of, but more just like,
yeah,
it's not even critical. It's I think more just like a heavy sigh and it's like, yeah, man, it's real bad. Like it's hard to just put your shit together.
Yeah. Like I think one of the things he does, like there's the Saunders voice, which is like pretty distinctive. And then there's like his kind of specificity with the corporate culture. Like, so everything at strip club Joysticks is like very structured. They have a word for like, do you want me to pilot your table? You know, like it's like an inverted like Red Lobster. Like it's the most boring strip club that you could possibly go to, because it's just like, and this guy is just on autopilot, no pun intended, but he's just like, he's just like does exactly what he's supposed to do. And then like somebody will tell him he's on autopilot with this dehumanizing shit where somebody's like, pick up this dollar, but turn around so I can look at your asshole.
Right. See your crack. Yeah.
And he's like, do I do it? Yes, I do. Usually. I think that part's interesting, like how he starts off, and it's just a litany of what he does for money and how much money. The question is like always, do I do it? And then he's like, yes, I do. And then he like draws like one or two lines. And then by the end, he's like, no, I'm going to do it all. And for a very specific goal, which is weirdly sweet, I guess. I think it does kind of humanize them and makes it a bit more depressing.
Yeah, because like making the jump from low class to even like low middle class.
Yeah.
Like it comes at a cost, right? He has to show his dick. You know, I can't remember if it's Min or June, but it's like to go get this job at the label store or whatever, you know, show some cleavage, show some leg, like, you know, you have to make compromises like that just to do a little bit of climbing.
Yeah.
And then still, like, even then, Nico, you mentioned corporate culture. Like, it makes me think of that scene where his boss at Joysticks, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but he's like, you know, I'm sorry your aunt just died, whatever, but go out there and show your cock. I mean, you have to.
Yeah.
We basically own you and.
Yeah. Or leave.
There's a great line about, like, should I just put an ad out asking all the sad people to come in and, yeah. and be sad and dance? No, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. You know, that's the kind of thing it made me think of, like, how often have I sat in a restaurant and been like, God, this waiter is fucking terrible. But then, you know, like,
yeah.
maybe his baby just died in a fire or something. Like, we don't really see them as...
Perhaps an extreme example.
But he needs to keep working to support his baby who didn't die. Yeah, in absolutely. Fire.
I mean, the Aunt Bernie's last lines are the core of the story, right? You know, why do some people have everything and I got nothing? And that seems to be the thing that everything is sort of like all the rest of it is kind of ornamentation around that idea that that's what the system is, that some people do get everything and some people get nothing at all. And there's, you know, stages in between, and it's not fair and it's not right and it's not good. And that's just, and then what can you say, right? Which strikes me as different than if this was a critical story. If this was trying to get you to be angry, it's not. I think it's different from Vonnegut in that way. Like, I think Vonnegut's approach here would be a much more, like, satirical, much more just like, the institutions are bad and we should think badly about them. Whereas this is more like, let's think of the people who live in this institution or who work through it and what they're going through and feel bad for them or feel empathy for them. And maybe recognize ourselves in them in some way too. That's what I got more from it. It's not sharp. It's not comforting either. It's just like,
yeah,
I don't know. It just has that sort of heaviness. It's like, yeah, man, this is what is out there.
He does kind of dance around like the pretty sharp criticism though, I think. Like just,
yeah,
especially with Min and Jade, they won't get jobs because they don't want the other one to not have a job and they have to work. But
right.
So they live in this complex where, like, they're stray bullets, like, constantly. And, like, stray bullet hits their kids, like, stroller. And they're still, like, don't want to get a job. But they also, like, won't say fuck because they're trying to set a good example. So they keep saying, like, freak. And, like, don't cuss around the kids. It's, like, that kind of thing, I feel like, is criticism. Pretty sharp.
Yeah, I mean, but it's, yeah, I think you're right. It's not, we're not supposed to think that they're characters that we admire or want to be like. No. But it's also, I don't think that the narrator or the Saunders voice here thinks it's their fault necessarily.
Yeah.
Or is blaming them for it. And I could be wrong about that, but that's kind of the feeling I got from it. The thing I like about the story that I think is worth noting is the, I don't know if it's new syntax, but like it seems like he kind of created his own little slang language. For especially the sisters, like the calling each other chick, right? And like there's a repeated thing where one of them says, like, I'm sure you're cussing at a gravesite or whatever, that kind of thing. Fucking yeah, love that. It's love so that. Good. It's such a specific twist on Valley Girl speak, kind of, but it's different. I never heard anyone speak like that really in real life. So it's not naturalistic dialogue. It just feels like warped naturalism, which is what this whole story is, warped naturalism, right? Such a careful attention to the choices in the writing, and I really dug that quite a bit. It makes me wonder, so part of the discussion here is this was turned into a TV show, a pilot for Amazon, right? That was what we decided or said was the case? That wasn't picked up, and I mean, I think that makes sense. I can't imagine this being a TV show.
Yeah.
Especially in 20, the story came out in 1998, and the pilot was in 2017.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah. There's just not enough here. I don't think these characters live beyond these pages, right? The world is so contained. But also the pleasure of reading the story and some of the things that make it so good are the reading parts of it, not just the plot details. Like, I want the Saunders voice, like you mentioned, Nico, is so crucial to the experience of the story. They just, like, filming it is like, well, it's not gonna resonate. I can't see this working at all as a TV show.
I feel like it would be a show like that. Was the Amelia Gray show, The Maniac?
Oh, yeah, right.
I feel like it's not the same, but it could translate into that sort of very kind of dense. That was a pretty dense show. You know, they fit a lot into a few episodes, and it sort of where it ended is not where it started kind of situation.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it would be good, but I can see them trying it.
Yeah, I can see the logic from a creative standpoint of like, oh, the world here is so rich in detail. You could populate an entire series of just those kind of like quirks and the titles, whatever. But that seems, I don't know, I'm not involved in TV production, so what the fuck do I know? But it seems pretty short-sighted in terms of what you have to look at the rest of the story. I don't want to explore the world where people come back from the dead and have these like weird directives and the powers that kind of fade or whatever. Like, I don't care if that's real or not. I don't want it to be. I want it to be a specific incident that happens that may or not even actually happen to them and is just contained to those characters in that story. I feel the same way about like all books that end up being adapted into TV shows that carry on, right? Like when they get to like the end of, what was that show, The Leftovers, which I heard was really good. I didn't watch the rest of the other seasons, but it's like when it like leaves the book and it's like, well, what else? It's like, no, the book is done. Like the author left the characters for a reason. I don't necessarily see, I don't always want it to carry on.
He wrote the show though.
Yeah, I guess that's the difference, is that you can go, and like comics does this all the time, so what am I complaining about? But it just feels weird to be like, I thought that story was done, and now it's like, no, there's more to say.
Yeah, but I'm with you.
Yep. It doesn't seem like the one I would pick.
No, definitely not.
Like, although it may, I don't, like, I mean, I could see, like, I can't, like you were saying, like, I can't imagine it being based around the family for 10 episodes or whatever, but maybe like the strip club? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe so. What I would be cool maybe is a TV show, an anthology TV show that is, they're all Saunders stories adapted in different ways because they do have a kind of a voice link or connection. That could be fun. I would definitely watch that.
Yeah.
But yeah, a whole series for this role, not so much. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for the collection. This was collected in, which is called Pastoralia, whatever it's pronounced. It. And there's a detail here that says the eponymous story inspired the Geico caveman ad campaign. Has anyone read that story?
Yeah, it's a good story.
It's like an amusement park.
Yeah. Did it really inspire the Geico caveman commercial?
I wouldn't be surprised. It's about this dude that lives in a fucking museum exhibit.
That's wild. Because that, like, we can...
Yeah, that's a really good collection.
Think about how often you see Geico commercials, like they play constantly on TV, but also they just become like these like whatever mainstream like memes in the culture, like all the different like offshoots, whatever, all some way stems from that caveman spot, which was like their first big viral sensation, right? So George Saunders is inadvertently responsible for like this weird ad universe that's like infected all of our brains. It all goes back to him. It's like insane. Like the emu or the camel saying hump day, whatever, the squirrels in the road, all the Geico commercials Saunders is responsible for inadvertently.
Yeah. Next time.
That's your interview question, Dave. Forget Big Toast. Ask about
you should
that.
Read. Have you read The Barber's Unhappiness from that collection? That is a fucking knockout story.
Just watch. It's even bigger toast.
I don't remember. Which one's that one?
It's about the barber who lives with his mom and gets into a relationship. Sort of. It's
unhappy.
Similar-ish voice to one. This. Ooh, so sad, man.
It's a really good collection.
Yeah. I got to do some catch-up Saunders reading for sure. I need to read Lincoln Lombardo, definitely. And there's a new collection out, right?
No, it's a nonfiction book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's like writing, it's like a craft book where he talks about four Russian stories.
Yeah, he does a class on Russian short stories. So he has picked out, like six or seven that he really likes, and he uses them sort of as a writing guide. But he publishes the stories in full in the book too. So you read the story and then afterwards he's like, so let's talk about this and this. And then like, here's an exercise and
that's awesome.
Whatever. It's like a written version of the class.
That sounds really cool. I should definitely read that. Any final thoughts on this story, fellas?
Just excellent. I mean, I feel like I could read it again today and be just as happy.
Yeah, I thought it really held up. I really like it. I mean, I like Saunders' style anyway, but this, it did really hit me. And those last lines especially, I think, are really strong. It's just it's a nice ending. It's not nice, but it's an impactful ending, which is good.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, listeners, tell us your thoughts on the Saunders story, Sea Oak, or other Saunders stories or whatever on Twitter at YakBabies, and also email us at YakBabiesPodcast@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts. Also, you can find our secret podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/YakBabies. For $1 a month, you get access to our bonus cast, which has all of our games and drunken ramblings and things cut out of the episode because they were too weird or offensive. And then also we have merch. You can find our merch link on Twitter. There's some really good mugs and posters and t-shirts that Brick is designing that are really top-notch stuff and very funny. The content mill is ever-grinding. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners, and especially their patrons, both past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, Roger, Kathleen, Bailey, Andrew, and William Howard Taft.